and welcome everybody to Podcasting Them Softly, episode number 4. Hey, Frank.
Hello.
Today we're gonna have a good show today. We got lots to talk about. We are going to Frank's going to provide some thoughts on the Avengers Part 2, Avengers Ultron, whatever they want to call it. He's going to talk about
Age of Ultron.
He's going to talk about it because he saw it. We're going to talk about our top 5 movies coming out to see this summer, given that it's the first weekend of the summer movie season. And then we are going to get into a more substantial offering, Steven Soderbergh's King of the Hill, rich nutrients there, good filmmaking. We'll get into that. And then we're going to get into our top 5 performances from Keira Knightley and Sam Rockwell. And then we're going to talk about some other stuff to close out, some DVDs and some Blu-rays. So without wasting any more time, Frank, I'm going to pass it off to you and love to hear your thoughts. Because you told me a little quick thing yesterday, but I've been waiting to hear you talk about the Avengers and what you thought.
Right on. I know we both said that we weren't going to go see it this weekend, but just to preface, my friend Peyton, who I always go see movies with, he'd been on my ass all week about going to see it. And I eventually told him, okay, we're good. Let's go see it. As you know, and I've said before on the podcast, that I'm not a Marvel guy. I don't care about Marvel movies. I don't get excited for them. I don't go out of my way to watch them. I own Captain America on Blu-ray. Love that. Thought the sequel was all right. Loved the Hulk movie with Norton. Loved Guardians of the Galaxy. I'll just say that. I love that so much more than I thought I would. That's by far the best Marvel movie, in my opinion. As for the first Avengers, I did see that in theaters. I didn't care for it. I know everybody else in the world loved it, and I'm in the minority on that one. And it was funny, my friend Peyton and I were talking about this, is I remember when they started to release casting for the Avengers sequel, and it broke that James Spader was going to voice Ultron. I shared the link on Peyton's Facebook, and I'm like, way to force our hands into wanting to go see this movie, because we both love James Spader, obviously. So the film itself, it was 2.5 hours. I didn't get bored too much through it. It's mainly all action. I liked it more than the first one. My problem with the first film was I didn't think that the villain that they had, Loki, was substantial enough to bring all the villains or all the Avengers together. I just thought it was kind of a weak villain. Regarding that, though, the best part of the movie is James Spader and his voice acting for Ultron, and I feel that Ultron is a more than suitable villain to bring all the Avengers together to stop the world from ending or whatever is going to happen. James Spader, bar none, is amazing in it. Loved it. Aside from that, it just gets bogged down in unnecessary storylines. There's an unnecessary love story that spawns in this that I don't care about. And I don't, you know, and then there's too much focus on the Hulk as well, with his inner confliction of how Bruce Banner's this, you know, a pacifist, and then when he gets excited or angry or his stress level reaches a certain point, he turns into the Hulk and he can't control it, and it just starts smashing everything. So there's that. The other part is I grow tired of the jokes every 5 minutes. It's too much for me. Whenever there's a fight scene, somebody kicks some ass, or Tony Stark swears, Captain America chastises him for using foul language. Basically, where I come from with this, and I know you are along the same lines with me, is Christopher Nolan and to a part, Tim Burton and Zack Snyder really spoiled us when it comes to superhero films. And I look at the Burton Batman movies, Man of Steel, the Dark Knight trilogy, the upcoming Batman vs. Superman, I look at those as films. As to where I look at the Marvel movies coming out as movies, it's just high octane. It's there to just entertain and smash and be really shiny and have Robert Downey Jr. doing his Robert Downey Jr. stick and everything. Not to say that that's bad, it's just not my thing. So, and to pull a line from you, how you just broke my heart into a million pieces and said the best part of the Phantom Menace was the Fight Club trailer that was in front of it. The best part of the Avengers Age of Ultron was the 3D Force Awakens trailer that was before it for me. So that was part of me, my excitement going into seeing the new Avengers was knowing that I was going to see the 3D Force Awakens trailer.
So you saw the movie then in 3D?
Yes. I mean, Peyton bought the tickets. I didn't know. I should have known it was in 3D. I didn't think anything of it, but I was like, I'll buy you lunch since you bought a ticket. And he's like, well, the tickets were $15. I'm like, oh, it's in 3D. And he's like, well, why wouldn't we go see it in 3D? I agreed with him. Why wouldn't we go see it in 3D?
Is Star Wars being shot in 3D?
I believe so.
Like natively shot with 3D cameras the real way, like the reason why...
I believe so. I don't know. I can't give you like a concrete answer, but I would imagine with J.J. Abrams and Industrial Light and Magic behind it, they're not going to do some shitty post-conversion.
Okay.
That's just my guess.
3D for me is...
It's a gimmick.
With a few exceptions that I have seen, and there have been a few, most notably Hugo. Martin Scorsese.
Hugo is great.
Martin Scorsese's Hugo in 3D absolutely took advantage of 3D and what 3D could offer in nearly every instance. Robert Zemeckis's use of 3D with the Christmas Carol and the Polar Express, I thought also were very solid, very innovative uses of the technology. But Avatar, the first time I saw Avatar in 3D, I'm not going to lie and say that I wasn't blown away. I was. I don't watch the movie repeatedly on Blu-ray. I own it. I've put it on like once or twice. But, you know, the first time I saw Avatar in the theater in 3D IMAX, it was pretty astonishing. But I'm not like just willy-nilly paying an extra $5 to see a movie in 3D just because they're, you know, they're going to do, like you said, a shitty post-conversion or even just a normal post-conversion. The 3D holds no appeal. I want to see movies. Like, if I go see The Avengers 2 or, you know, Age of Ultron, I will track down a 2D showing.
Right. I'm not going to go out of my way on a home video. I don't own a 3D TV. I think my Blu-ray player is 3D, and I have a couple 3D Blu-rays, like Hugo and whatever came in a bundle.
Yep.
Because I thought one day I'll get a 3D TV, which I ended up not getting a 3D TV when I bought a new TV. But I will say that as far as 3D goes, obviously Avatar goes without saying. And Tron Legacy I loved in 3D. Thought that was perfectly suited for 3D.
That also was visually spectacular in 3D.
Life of Pi, I think you'd have to see that in 3D as well.
Yes.
Because watching that in 2D as opposed to 3D is not going to be the same experience.
I would agree with you on that as well. That movie was also amazing in the 3D format.
And so, yeah, just to sum up Avengers, I'm sure people are going to love it. People who love the first one are going to love the second one. For me, it was something I'll probably never watch again.
There you go. All right. Well, I will offer my comments when I do see it. If I don't see it in the theater, I will check it out on Blu-ray. I gather that there will be a longer, quote-unquote, director's cut or an extended cut or some sort. So if I don't get a chance to see it in the theater for whatever reason, then it'll be something to look forward to, I guess, in some respect, when it, you know, lands at home and I can watch it in my living room. But why don't we go into our top five most anticipated movies for the summer? Unless there's anything more you'd like to add on the Avengers, don't want to.
No, good. Let's go to the top five summer movies.
You want to do yours? You want me to do mine first? You want me to?
Yeah, I'll go. I'll go in essentially descending order, since that's what we're going to do from this point forward. My fifth one, straight out of Compton. I saw the trailer for it. I didn't think I was going to have any interest in it, and the trailer grabbed me, and I thought it looked good, and it made me realize, or I should say, remember the importance of that music and of Oh, geez, I just totally blanked. What is it? Help me out here.
NWA.
NWA. I thought Paul Giamatti looked awesome in it. And I thought the movie looked good in general. But, my buddy Peyton came over. He's like, dude, you seen the Straight Outta Compton trailer? I'm like, what do you think? He's like, you got to watch it. So we put it on my TV, and I was like, you know what? I'm actually going to go see that. That looks good. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for it.
I have, and I I won't spoil my picks. I have seen the trailer. I'll just put it to you this way: I've watched the trailer probably about 10 times.
Okay, cool. Number four is Maggie, the Schwarzenegger zombie movie.
Yep.
New spin on a zombie movie, and it's gotten a lot of press of Schwarzenegger giving a dramatic performance. Regardless or not, if Schwarzenegger gives a dramatic, soul-bearing performance, I don't care. If he gives a great dramatic performance, awesome. I'll be able to see him with acting chops. If he's just pulling zombies' heads off and killing them with his bare hands, that's fine with me. Whether or not it's a B-movie or an art film, I don't care. I want to see it. I think the premise sounds good. I think the trailer looks good. Really enjoyed it.
Me too. It looks good.
The number three is Poltergeist. Saw the trailer for it when I saw Ex Machina, which I still don't think I'm saying it right, in theaters. And I loved it. I thought it looked awesome. Poltergeist is a classic. It's something that you can't really fuck around with too much, although all the classics kind of got redone. I always looked at Poltergeist as on the tier of, on the tier of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Halloween, but how many times have both those movies just gotten shitty sequels and shitty remakes and stuff? So I guess Poltergeist isn't a classic that you can't fuck around with. But that being said, this looks good. It looks really good. Sam Rockwell looks like Sam Rockwell and Jared Harris are in it. I mean, that adds validity to the film for me. I love both of them.
Yeah,
and I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, and it's got Rosemary DeWitt, whom I'm a big fan of too.
Right, there you go. My second one is Terminator Genisys. I love all I love every time I go on Facebook or whenever they release the poster for it. This past week, and it shows, you know, Schwarzenegger and Emilia Clarke, and then it shows Jason Clarke, who plays John Connor, and he's coming out of flames, and he's a Terminator body or an android body or something like that. And then everybody's just like, oh my God, they gave away the movie, and oh my God, this is just too many spoilers on this poster. It's like, how can the fuck can it be a spoiler when they released a poster? And, you know, I'm assuming this is part of the the new storyline of the new trilogy where, you know, the original trilogy isn't necessarily canon anymore. It's backstory, but they're taking it in a new direction, and I'm excited to see where it goes. People get too fucking bent out of shape about shit. It's not like the Terminator franchise is Star Wars or something. Just saying. But, and honestly, the first and Judgment Day are really the only good ones. Rise of the Machines, just not good. I like the ending. I like the actual storyline of it, but it's just not a good film for the most part. And Salvation I liked, but Salvation really didn't do much for me either. I might own that, actually. But anyway, yeah, Terminator Genisys I want to see. I love Schwarzenegger. As big of a pompous film snob as I am, anytime Schwarzenegger or Stallone are coming out with a new movie, I'm going to go see it. And 9 times out of 10, I'm going to enjoy it. So looking forward to that. I mean, come on, dude. It's Schwarzenegger fighting a younger version of himself. He's fighting the Terminator from the original Terminator movie. It's fucking awesome. And Emilia Clarke is Sarah Connor. And Jason Clarke is John Connor. It's got a nice little cast. And J.K. Simmons is in it.
Excellent cast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes with the new Terminator film. And obviously, it goes without saying, my most anticipated movie comes out in 2 weeks is Mad Max Fury Road, which just looks like, I mean, I don't even know how to describe how glorious this honestly just looks like, I don't know, somebody just jerked off on the screen, and I'm just going to sit there and watch. I mean, it's just insane. What, the whole movie is just one entire chase? That's essentially what it is? I mean, what the fuck? And Tom Hardy? I mean, yeah. Tom Hardy?
And you got Charlize Theron with that arm, and Yeah.
Right. Black shit on her face. I mean, yep. This just looks like something I'm just going to sit and just enjoy the fuck out of.
Yeah.
So that's my top five. I don't know who would be jerking off on the screen. George Miller, the director, I'm assuming. But whatever, I'll sit there and watch it. It's fucking, anyway, go, before I get carried away.
No worries. My number five is going to be Magic Mike XXL.
Of course Magic Mike XXL would be your number five.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see it. I thought that the first Magic Mike movie was pretty much brilliant. And we get into our Steven Soderbergh talk. We'll talk about King of the Hill, and obviously I'm sure we'll digress here and there into some other Soderbergh stuff. But big fan of the original Magic Mike, really liked it a lot. This one is going to be interesting, most notably because it is directed by Soderbergh's longtime assistant director, Gregory Jacobs, who has also made a couple of films as well as a full-fledged director. But this one was actually shot and edited by Soderbergh. So it'll be interesting to see, a movie that's not directed by him, but that he was the cinematographer and editor on. I'm a Soderbergh nut, so I can't wait to see it. Number four is F. Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton. Like I said, I have watched the trailer repeatedly. Excuse me. Big fan of that music. That was when I was, growing up, when I was, 10, 11, 12, 13, starting to buy CDs on my own. Definitely, one of the many white boys listening to NWA, in the suburbs. And, while definitely not being anywhere near the, the race riots that accompanied this, the emergence of that music, that this movie is clearly going to show. It's definitely part of my upbringing, my childhood, and I can't wait to see it. Paul Giamatti does look fantastic. The people that they've cast as the young Dr. Dre and Eazy-E and the whole group looks terrific. So can't wait to see it. I think it could be a really big hit. My number three is Andrew Niccol's Good Kill. Question being, how big of a release is this movie going to get? I'm a big fan of Andrew Niccol. He hasn't made – every movie that he's made hasn't been great, but when he is great, he is great. And I'm really looking forward to seeing this. This is the Ethan Hawke movie where he is the drone operator. I don't know how familiar you are with this. Maybe we've talked about it here and there, or if you've seen the trailer for Good Kill. But it looks like a very cerebral, dark, Andrew Niccol did Lord of War with Nicolas Cage. Huge fan of that movie. Very underrated in my book. So Good Kill looks to be sort of in the same sort of half action, half satire, half social commentary. So look forward to that as well. Number two is going to be Brad Bird's Tomorrowland.
How did I miss that on my list?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Very anxious to see this one. I think that it looks wildly imaginative. This is at least my hope, that it is wildly imaginative and that it really takes you to somewhere you've not been before. I don't really get exactly what is going on from the trailers. I have an idea of where the story is going, but I have to say that I'm pleasantly not 100% filled in. It looks like they've done a really clever job of sort of hiding the A story, I feel, and they are showing you like the B and C story a lot, and then some sort of random shots of effects.
Right.
I think they're kind of keeping this one a little bit close, to the vest. What was interesting, the newest trailers are spotlighting the fact that it is PG, which is not necessarily a problem, but I thought that was interesting that it is not a PG-13 movie, that it will be rated PG, which will lean squarely, maybe a little bit more squarely towards families than, having an edge, quote unquote. But you got the Clooney factor, can't wait. Brad Bird, gotta love him. That's the girl who's in it, she's on the show Under the Dome, which I didn't watch all of the first season. I kind of tuned out, but she was pretty good on it. Yep, she was pretty good on that show, and I think, she could be good, but looks very cool visually.
I think Under the Dome would have been good if it wouldn't have been on broadcast TV.
Yeah, that's exactly. Under the I don't know if you got into The Leftovers on HBO.
Yeah, The Leftovers, boom. That show.
The Leftovers
second season.
Yeah, Leftovers was terrific. Loved it. And The Leftovers to me is basically like, you know, Under the Dome, but, you know, not, you know, I mean, not exactly the same show, but I don't know if you see the correlation I'm making.
No, I do. Just real quick, I just want to say something about The Leftovers. I love the first season. My buddies and I loved it. And I loved all the people that didn't like it. And, it, you know, the outcry of like, well, they didn't explain what happened. It's like, well, they don't need to, and they're probably not going to. And this is the story about the people that are left after whatever happened. They don't even know.
If you went into that show thinking that you were going to get any sort of explanation, listen, I was skeptical about The Leftovers because of how annoyed that I was about, and this is probably worth another podcast, but I was a huge fan of Lost. I'm talking.
Yeah, I never watched it.
Okay. I was addicted to Lost, and I hated the finale to Lost. I felt cheated. I thought it was garbage. I couldn't stand it. And that finale has soured me on Lost. So, really did. Like, pissed me off. And it was abundantly clear that they didn't know what the fuck they were doing, and they can bullshit themselves in the media all that they want. They didn't know what they were doing. What was initially clever and mind-bending and wild and cool and worth me racing home through Los Angeles traffic to get home and see it before I had TiVo or DVR back in the day, it seems so long ago, that show was my crack rock. And they shit all over it, in my opinion, with the finale. I hated it. So that being said...
I can just feel the anger.
I was annoyed. I was really annoyed. And so with that being said, The Leftovers appealed to me. There were two factors about The Leftovers that were initially very appealing. The Peter Berg factor and the fact that it was based on a book written by the guy who wrote Little Children, which I think is a great movie. I don't know if you've seen Little Children.
Little Children is fantastic.
Okay, we'll do a podcast on that one too. I'm glad you're a huge fan. In any event, those two, the Peter Berg, Tom Perrotta factors outweighed the Damon Lindelof factor. And isn't that the guy that's on the Leftovers, Lindelof, the clown?
Yeah, okay.
So I said to myself, I'm going to try The Leftovers. We're going to see what happens. I'm never going to expect them to answer the questions that they're going to raise on this heady, beyond unexplainable concept if everyone just vanished. There is no satisfactory answer for such a crazy idea. So I said to myself, I'll give it a chance. Slowly became addicted, think it's terrific, but I have set my expectations in a sort of a different way. So hopefully whenever it comes for that show to end, they stick the landing. In any event, get back to the summer movie preview. Number one for me, without a doubt, Mad Max. It looks, like you said, like an orgasm. It doesn't even look real. It looks just, I mean, it looks too real to the point where you're saying this can't be real. I don't understand the guys going back and forth on those massive pogo sticks. I don't understand the people playing a rock concert in the middle of the whole thing. Don't care. It looks absolutely insane. George Miller is a nut. I love the two Babe movies. And obviously the original Mad Maxes are a blast. This one looks to just be the end all be all of watching shit explode. And, you know, Tom Hardy, the whole cast, the whole idea. I'm slowly starting to put together the pieces. It's like the first few times you watch that trailer, it is so overwhelming that like, you're not even like paying attention to anything else except for the visuals. Am I right?
Right. I don't think you have any idea what the fuck's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
And then with the new trailers, it's like, okay, he gets released at the beginning. Yep. And I don't know.
Some sort of group of like five supermodels that are like barely dressed that are being being dragged around the desert and like they need to be protected and whatnot. I'm so freaking there to see that. That will be I have the day off on that Friday. And
you want to see it at midnight?
No, I'll be seeing that movie like a first show or second show on that Friday with my dad. We're going to go check that out together. So I can't wait to see it. That's definitely my number one. And then I'll just throw really quickly a couple of other titles out there that we hope we don't get lost in the huge onslaught of summer movies. There's going to be a film called Love and Mercy coming out, which is about the Beach Boys with Paul Dano and John Cusack. And it's supposed to be excellent. I've been hearing like amazing buzz on it. Paul Dano sounds like he gives an amazing performance. There is a smaller film coming out this summer called American Ultra, and it's some sort of marijuana thriller action comedy with Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart. And I thought the two of them were terrific together in Adventureland. And this one I haven't seen a trailer for, but the ingredients on paper seem like they could be kind of fun. It seems almost like a Pineapple Express, but maybe a little darker and a little bit more serious. The Mission Impossible movie looks like a lot of fun, but I am so irritated with Tom Zenu Cruz at this point after watching the Scientology documentary that he has been soured on me for the moment. And I also wanted to mention the new Judd Apatow comedy Trainwreck with Bill Hader and this fairly new comedian who I'm not 100% familiar with, Amy Schumer. The trailers definitely look sweet, looks funny, looks like maybe a return to knocked up territory for Apatow. And the Jurassic World film. Where are you on Jurassic World? Yeah, right?
I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool Chris Pratt was going to be in it. and then I saw the first trailer that came out for it, and the bad dinosaur is genetically engineered or something like that, and I just lost interest with it.
Too.
I don't really care.
I don't really care. I mean, it's interesting. I have more interest in seeing Jurassic World than I do in seeing the Avengers, just because the little kid. Yeah, just because the little kid in me really, really, really liked dinosaurs, and I want to see like cool dino fighting and whatnot. But that being said, the special effects looked suspiciously not great, and I really would have thought that at this point they would have looked maybe a little bit cleaner. But you know, the Chris Pratt thing is there, and I like him; he's a funny guy. But yeah, I'm not working up a massive head of steam to see it. Southpaw could be a surprise.
Yeah, does that come out this summer?
Yeah, that comes out late July, I think. And that's the Jake Gyllenhaal boxing film. That looks solid, looks very good. Gyllenhaal, I'm wondering if it's going to be a decent movie with a great Gyllenhaal performance, or if it's...
That's what I thought when I saw the trailer.
Yeah, like, you know, and as much as I like Antoine Fuqua, for me, he's kind of a filmmaker that is a little too, like, on the nose and blunt, and there's not a lot of subtlety with his films. And I've liked a lot of his stuff. Training Day, King Arthur, I really enjoyed. I was not hot on The Equalizer. I was not a huge fan of that movie.
Equalizer was all right. I loved Brooklyn's Finest. I think that's his best movie.
Brooklyn's Finest is definitely his best film overall. I don't think that there's any question about that. That had the best script. It had the most surprise. It, you know, overall had the best performances. I mean, Training Day, I still think kicked a lot of ass.
I like Training Day.
And King Arthur's fairly underrated.
I liked King Arthur a lot too. Yeah.
Yeah. So Southpaw could surprise, and Jonathan Demme has a new movie this summer, which easily could get lost.
Really.
Yeah, it's called Ricky and the Flash. It stars Meryl Streep, and I'm trying to remember who the male lead is.
Jesus, a fucking Jonathan Demme movie with Meryl Streep?
Yeah.
That should be number one on my list.
I'm assuming that you're being sarcastic.
No.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure. I couldn't
seriously,
tell
like Jonathan Demme and Meryl Streep?
I love Jonathan Demme. I was a huge fan. I wasn't sure how much of a Meryl Streep fan you were. I believe that it has to do with her playing an aged rock star. And she retires from the life on the road and I think wants to settle down.
I'm looking this shit up.
Yeah, I haven't seen a trailer, but I just know that Demme had a new movie. One more I will throw your way too is the Cameron Crowe film Aloha, which has gotten all sorts of mixed buzz online because of this, you know, the Sony email leaks.
Hang on. Yeah. And Kevin Kline's in this movie.
That's right. It's Kevin Kline. That's right.
And Rick Springfield. And the chick that wrote Juno and shit wrote it.
Oh, that's right. It's Diablo Cody's screenplay for Jonathan Demme. That's right. I forgot.
This is going to be pretty fucking good. Just saying.
Yes. So that one is something to watch out for. And Aloha, the Bradley Cooper comedy. Is it a comedy? What is it? This movie that takes place in Hawaii with...
I don't know. It's Cameron Crowe doing his thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, which could be interesting. I like all the people in it, and Cameron Crowe, you know, I'm looking forward. I don't know how much of a fan you were of Vanilla Sky. The Blu-ray is
finally... I like that a lot.
Yeah, me too. The Blu-ray is finally coming out. It's been delayed like 3 or 4 times now. I don't know why they keep delaying the Blu-ray release, but it's coming out this summer, and I can't wait to see that. So overall, I think that it might be a summer that's dominated by some of the smaller movies rather than the huge blockbusters. You know, and there's still some things that I'm not, you know, that we're leaving out. Fantastic Four and David Gordon Green's got a little movie with Pacino called Manglehorn, which could be like a fun independent movie.
What about Danny Collins?
Danny Collins, that was already released.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that kind of came and went. It was supposed to be like cute,
it just looked,
you know,
shitty.
Yeah, it didn't look great.
Too bad. Al Pacino and Christopher Plummer. I was like all excited, and then I saw the whole trailer, and I was just like, oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we get into King of the Hill, I just want to make the announcement of our free Sleaze Fest giveaway of Color of Night and Plant God on Blu-ray. Allie Mandy is our winner. I'm not sure if you're Facebook friends with them, but
yes, I am. That's
a Facebook
that's
friend
awesome.
Of mine. So
you're gonna you're gonna facilitate that?
Yeah, I'll message them and ship that off to them. So thanks for everybody that participated in that. I'm sure we'll be doing another one sometime soon.
Yes, we will. We'll keep those kind of things going. I'll come up with something on that end for the next one.
Awesome.
So yeah. Let's get into our featured film for the day, Steven Soderbergh's King of the Hill. Do you want me to – I'll just kick off, you know, with this.
Yeah, you go ahead. It was your pick. You go. You go with it.
It's just, you know, I can't say – you know, I can't say, you know, I could just sit here and I could talk all day about it. It's a great movie. It's a movie that no one ever thinks about when they talk about Steven Soderbergh. He, you know, is a filmmaker that has gone back and forth between – big studio movies and small independent experimental stuff and mid-size, you know, independent or studio thrillers, you know, or dramas. You know, there really isn't a genre that he hasn't tried. He's one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. Absolutely love his style, how it's emerged throughout the years, changed, shifted. And the movie that sort of strikes as an anomaly in his career would be this movie, King of the Hill. It came out in 93, and if I'm not mistaken, this was his third film, and after making a big splash with Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And then I don't know if you've seen Kafka, the black and white.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, very cool film, and I gather he's doing a new edit or something. There was some rumor online about how he was going to be recutting it and trying to get it out on Blu-ray or some sort. He put it up on his own personal website for a little while, and there's ways to see it. It's very interesting. It's very cool. But this is a very interesting film. This is a movie about a young boy and his family during the Great Depression. It's St. Louis, correct? It's the Midwest?
Yep,
yep, St. Louis.
Missouri.
And he basically what happens is the father, and I don't want to spoil too much because it really is a wonderful movie. Father's a salesman, traveling salesman, or forced to become a traveling salesman when work is dried up. His mother's sick with tuberculosis. She's sent to an infirmary to get, you know, treated. And his youngest brother is sent off to live with, you know, more well-off family members, I think an aunt or an uncle, they offer to take him in. So you essentially get to see how a child, and I say a child, he's probably, 12, 13, I believe is his age.
Yeah, he's graduating eighth grade.
So he's graduating eighth grade, and you see life pretty much exclusively through his eyes.
I don't think there's any scenes that aren't told with his perspective. There's a couple of overflow scenes with Spalding Gray.
Yep.
But you see everything through his perspective.
And it's a remarkable performance on the part of Jesse Bradford, who has had an interesting career after being a child actor. He's been in some things, most notably I would probably say Flags of Our Fathers with Clint Eastwood's movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, here it's just one of those performances where so much rest. When you ask a young actor, you know, a child actor, quote unquote, to have that much dialogue, have that much emotional vulnerability, to be asked to go to those places, the entire film's going to hinge on whether or not the actor that you've chosen is going to be up to that task. And there really isn't one scene where Bradford is not up to that task. He's heartbreaking at times. He's funny. The movie is sentimental without being cloying. It's sad without being, you know, overly maudlin. Soderbergh, you know, a lot of people have talked about how Soderbergh he's a cold filmmaker. He's detached. You know, his characters are pawns. He uses the characters a lot. I've heard this, you know, these criticisms before, criticisms or compliments, if you will, because I think a lot of his movies actually work because of the way that he structures his characters. Here, there is a clear love for the characters in a way that in even some of his best films, I haven't felt the love that he has for the boy and for his situation. And I think that it's just because Soderbergh is who he is as a filmmaker. He's not interested in sugarcoating stuff. So while the film has a beautiful, gorgeous, widescreen look with the sepia tone, and it's sort of pretty, you know, sort of makes everything pretty around it, I know that he has criticized himself on his artistic decisions with that movie, I think unfairly. It's just a very striking film to come from Soderbergh, who I think a lot of people think of as more handheld and off the cuff and sort of rough and tumble. And here everything is given that, you know, that fantastic CinemaScope old school look. He never sidesteps the emotion of the film and of the reality of the situation of this kid. And I'll let you get into some of your initial comments. But there's that one scene where, I don't want to spoil everything, but there's that one wonderful, great scene where the boy is very hungry, is forced to imagine what it would be like to eat a plate of food. And he does it with the magazine clippings. And
that's pretty potent shit, man.
It really is. And it's a movie. And, you know, this is a film that escaped people. It barely got released. It was very well reviewed by critics. They liked it a lot. It didn't get any Academy Award nominations. It completely came and went. And it's a movie that if you see, I'd be hard-pressed to understand how you could ever forget that one scene at the table with him eating, you know, eating like that. So curious to hear what you have to say about it, because I know that it was a film that you hadn't seen. I had seen it once before I revisited it last week, so you've had a chance now to see it for the first time.
Yeah, before I get into it, what made you pick this film?
What made me pick this film is that, simply put, in my opinion, it's just one of the great lost movies, and I say that because Soderbergh is a major filmmaker. He is a restless filmmaker. He has made almost a movie in a year, if not two at times. Incredibly prolific. Between making Warner Brothers a zillion bucks with the Oceans movies and making, you know, something like The Good German or Full Frontal or The Girlfriend Experience, he's a guy that, you know, he's interested in challenging himself. The late run of Haywire, Magic Mike, Contagion, just terrific stuff, really good stuff, always interested in skewering genre. This movie plays it straight. It doesn't have a condescension sometimes, how his movies sort of, you know, he's a smart guy. He's a very smart filmmaker. The Informant, take a look at The Informant, you know, only a brilliant person would have been able to put together all of the pieces to make up The Informant, how satirical and funny and black-hearted that movie is, if you will. And here's this movie that no one thinks about, no one gave any credence to. Universal Pictures, they had started Gramercy Films back in the early 90s. This was the first Gramercy release. So my guess is that it was treated like an experiment, where a big Universal Pictures wants to get into the independent movie game. Well, what's our first movie we're going to release? This little movie that we don't know how to sell or we don't know what to do with, not starring big blockbuster names. but featuring a great list of characters and a great list of actors. So that's why I picked it. It's just, it's a movie for me that just got just unfairly lost.
Okay, right on. Firstly, I want to say thanks for putting this on my radar. I'm sure I had seen it on Soderbergh's IMDb page when I've looked at it. I might not have ever seen this if you didn't want to do this film. I'm a Criterion aficionado, and I know they put it out, but I don't buy every Criterion that gets released. Sometimes, more times than not, I blind buy them, but that's because it's a film I've always wanted to see, or it's by a filmmaker I love, or an actor's in it. And I love this film, and I know I told you when I watched it that thanks for putting this on the map for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. All that being said, I know you love Soderbergh. I like Soderbergh. I own a lot of his films. I own Traffic. I have the Oceans trilogy. I don't know. I may own Contagion. The Limey is my favorite of his.
Yeah, the Limey is just the editing in the Limey is a masterclass of technique. It's amazing.
I thoroughly enjoyed Contagion. I like that. I loved Girlfriend Experience. What was the movie he did with Channing Tatum and Rooney Mara?
Yeah, that's really good, too. Side Effects. It's like his sexy
Side Effects, I thought, was, yeah. See, here's my thing with Soderbergh. And I know you're going to disagree with me here, and I'm going to tread lightly, because I know you love him so much. But sometimes I think Soderbergh gets caught up in himself.
Oh, yeah.
Haywire, I liked Haywire. I loved the cast more than anything. I loved all the small performances by actors that I love. Magic Mike just completely, I don't understand why people love it so much. I mean, I don't even know if it's the people love it so much or if it's like diehard Soderbergh people that keep holding the flag for it, but I didn't care for Magic Mike. Maybe I should rewatch it now because I have the newfound respect for Tatum and particularly Matthew McConaughey. But
it's a very
always
smart movie. Dude, listen, he gives you the promise of seeing Channing Tatum and all of these guys naked, right, or half naked.
Yeah, that's
and
fine.
Then he waits half an hour before he delivers any of it. And I'm sitting in the theater I'm the only guy in the theater I dragged my wife to go see this movie in the theater. I wanted to see it more than she did.
Your poor wife.
Okay. And, you know, I know we've had this conversation. I liked it more than she did. She didn't hate the film. She didn't love the film. I think she was somewhere in between on it. That movie is smart. It's got a lot to say. I would say see it again. He makes all of those panting women in the theater wait a half an hour before they see one exposed nipple or dimple of the ass on Tatum.
That's fine, man.
Okay.
But like, and then the sequel's coming out because, of course, there's going to be a sequel to Magic Mike.
Of course, it made a lot of money.
And I mean, Matthew McConaughey's not in it, so just saying that. But
nope. He was a huge reason why I loved the first one. So yes, you have to impress me more.
But here's the thing. Of course, he's not going to direct it, but he's going to shoot it and edit it. It's like, come on, dude. I get it.
He shoots and edits all of his stuff under two pseudonyms. Keep that in mind.
Right, but this isn't his.
No, but at the end of, but you also are aware that he shot second unit for The Hunger Games.
Correct. That's like another thing. It's like, dude, come on. I
just love that about him. Like, I love that. Like, I love
that. I get that you're an auteur, but all right, anyway.
You're an auteur, but at the same time, you're totally cool with going and shooting the second unit on The Hunger Games because you've never once played in that field, and I don't feel like maybe taking on a whole Hunger Games movie myself, but I'd kind of like to see what it would be like to shoot the action.
That's also called pretentious, but that's fine too.
To me, that's expanding yourself and wanting to do things and not
okay.
being restless. And, well, you know, you got to see The Nick because The Nick.
I know, I saw the pilot. I liked the pilot. I don't have Cinemax. I don't have a means to.
Yeah. Well, when the Blu-ray, that will be a gorgeous Blu-ray set just because of the way he shot it and everything. I mean, The Nick was appointment TV last summer. I can't wait for the second season. Obviously, you can tell, you know, as much as, you know, as much as you're a Star Wars guy, I'm a Steven Soderbergh guy. So
that's fucked up, though.
Well, I just can't.
I mean, come on.
I just can't. I can't find fault in a filmmaker who makes a film like Schizopolis.
That's called a bromance.
Yeah, but he made Schizopolis. Have you seen Schizopolis?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay. I'm like you with,
all right, but anyway,
like
right,
the Criterion.
Okay.
I'm like you with the Criterion Collection. I blind buy Criterion movies because I know that I need to have them sometimes. I know I need to see them. They're important films. That's why they're on the Criterion Collection. And I have movies I still haven't seen yet that I own on the Criterion
Collection.
Same here. Schizopolis, right, anyway, should be one that you blind buy, buddy.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe one day. When Soderbergh gets off of his high horse, I will buy it and I will watch it.
Well, do you think that he'll do you think that we'll see a film with him directed by Steven Soderbergh on the big screen again?
Oh, of course. He's not going to retire. Is that what you're talking about? Are you talking about his retirement, or are you talking about me going to see a movie that he directed?
No. Meaning now that he's committed to the second season fully of The Nick.
Oh yeah, dude. He's not going anywhere.
I hope that he makes a movie again. It's just going to be it'll be a while.
Trust me. There's no way. He's fucking going to make more movies. He can't not.
He's too, in my opinion, he's an insane genius. That's all I'll say. He's anybody that can make Schizopolis and then make Ocean's 11 and then make Traffic and Aaron Brockovich in the same year and get a porn star to make a movie like The Girlfriend Experience. Do you ever see Bubble? The movie that takes place in the doll factory with the unknown, the amateur actors.
No. Here's all right. we're getting carried away here. I get it.
It's utterly brilliant.
Put your Soderbergh boner back in your pants and stop slapping me across the cheeks with it. we're good.
But getting back to King of the Hill.
Getting back to point with King of the Hill. All right, so I read the synopsis when I knew this is what you wanted to do, and of course I bought it when I went on my last Amazon binge, but I read the synopsis and I was just like, okay, here we go with Soderbergh. Like, it's a coming-of-age Great Depression story. It's like I've seen this story 100 times through different mediums. I just wasn't that excited about seeing it. I popped the disc in, loved the menus, and I started the film. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. This isn't my bag here. I do like period piece films. Depression films are fine. I'm more of an English period piece, classic literature guy. That's more of my fetish for
history,
period piece films. Generally, that's what I watch. But anyway, I loved it. I love that it was all told from Jesse Bradford's perspective. I loved the subtlety of it. I loved the cast. It had no big names. Really, I would say probably Karen Allen is the most well-known actor that's in the film due to Indiana Jones and stuff like that. But it's not like she was box office draw or had box office star power. Love the cast. I loved her. I loved Adrian Brody's character. He was my favorite character. I love Spalding Gray's character. I love the dad. I love the mom. I love the brother. I even loved little Katherine Heigl.
Yeah, best performance, right?
easily her best performance. She doesn't do much in the film, but she's the girl that he likes in school. What struck me when I first started watching it, and I think I was 10, 15. I don't know when I sent you the message about it, but the production value of the film was unbelievable. I mean, it was Norman Rockwell-esque.
Yes,
I felt like I was in the Dust – well, not the Dust Bowl, but I felt like I was in the Great Depression watching the film. It all felt real. It all felt authentic without having too much of a polish on it where you know you're watching like this glamorized movie where it shows – you know what I mean? When you watch stuff – where it glamorizes stuff. I don't know why it's coming into my head, but like the Redford Great Gatsby film. It's like I watch it and it's just like all polished and it's all shiny.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't.
Yeah, it feels lit.
Seabiscuit's a better example because it's set during the Depression. The Tobey Maguire stuff is polished and stuff. I still love Seabiscuit and that's a good movie, but that's just the example that I'm using. It's not polished, but it looks beautiful. The dirt, the blowing dust, the wallpaper coming off the walls in the hotel, the stains on the doorway, the bellhop's black teeth. Everything was a perfect culmination of Soderbergh's aesthetic, and it was truly a remarkable film. If The Last Picture Show was in color, it would look like King of the Hill.
Very good. Yeah, absolutely. And I look forward to seeing The Last Picture Show again coming up. It's in my movies to
BBS
watch.
BBS box set, man. Yep. That's the best set I've ever owned. The Criterion BBS, yep. New Hollywood movie, the Rafelson set. But yep. Yeah, that to me, that's what it was when I was watching it. It was The Last Picture Show in color. I think The Last Picture Show is better, but I think Last Picture Show is on a high tier that not many films reach. Anyway, I wasn't trying to take anything away from King of the Hill by saying
yeah.
that. But also, I loved Cliff Martinez's score.
Yes.
Absolutely loved it. I didn't know he did the score for a lot of Soderbergh films. It makes perfect sense when I thought about it after you told me that. I just knew him from the Drive.
Yeah.
Or from the film Drive. And I bought that soundtrack because I loved the score so much
yeah.
to it.
Cliff Martinez, yeah, he's done a lot of Soderbergh. You know, he's also worked. Soderbergh's worked with some other guys too, but Martinez has been scoring his stuff for a long time, and I'm pretty sure he did the score to Contagion.
And yeah, he did. I looked him up, and Contagion had a score. I loved Contagion.
Yeah, me too.
I loved Contagion, and that was a fantastic score. I said the strong performance. I can't say enough about the performances. They all felt real. They all added. They flushed out the movie, and I particularly
the father was so good. Like.
How do you say that guy's name?
Yaron Krabi? Krobi?
Krabi?
Yeah.
That guy's awesome. I've only seen him in what? Like The Fugitive?
Yeah.
Ocean's 12? The Dolph Lundgren Punisher film. He's the bad guy in it. He was just phenomenal in King of the Hill.
I know.
And I couldn't help but make this comparison to Christoph Waltz.
Yes.
Because he's German in it, and
the tough
he
love,
is...
the tough love thing that I like. This is the deal: you want to live, your mother's got to go so she can get fixed up. I don't have enough money. I got to hit the road.
Here's a quarter.
Here's a quarter. You man up, do it. It wasn't because he didn't love him; it's because that was the reality of the situation. And
right.
And you had to figure out how to provide, and I can only imagine what it must have been like for so many families back then and how it is now. You know, we're not running, you know, depending on where you are.
Like he didn't have it that bad in a way. Because there's a couple scenes where he's on the train or the tram, and he goes past the Hooverville, and he sees one of his old neighbors. And then towards the end of the film, when that Hooverville is getting all torn down across from the hotel, he doesn't have it that bad, but yeah, he does because he's left on his own. There's
yeah.
no one there, and he has to rely on himself. Adrian Brody helps him, but then
He's given a boost by some key people, but it is really a story
of self-reliance.
And I'm almost positive that it's based on a memoir.
I looked
yes.
it up.
So even more, you know, poignant when you think about it. And, you know, if what we're describing sounds, again, depressing and whatnot, I would err more on the side of realistically moving than I would, you know, overly depressing.
It's funny and it's touching and it's heartfelt. And like I said, when I watched the ending, when the ending happened, and I almost felt like I was going to cry. I was so touched by the ending. And the ending, I don't want to say anything about the ending or lead people to believe what it is, but I will say that I didn't think that was going to be the ending.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was going to have a much different ending, but I thought it was absolutely perfect how everything was tied together, and the father just like hit a home run at the end of the film. It was just, I was blown away by it. I was just so overwhelmed, and it was so emotional. I'm going to watch this film again. I'll probably watch it at least once a year.
Yeah, it's
and,
a once.
Like,
see,
thank
it
you
is.
So much for putting this on my radar and getting me
of
to
course.
Watch it, because I absolutely loved it.
It's a once a year type movie. My wife, you know, thankfully she's very patient with, you know, all the movie watching that goes on in this house. She's not.
I just feel so bad for your wife sometimes. When you tell me what you guys are watching, it's just like, oh, that poor woman.
Well,
but
she's not one to
anyway.
Watch, she's not one to watch movies over and over again. She's a kind of a
one, right.
Like
one and done.
One and done. The King of the Hill, she watched again, and right after it was over, she looked at me and said, I could watch that movie again. And I think that it's one of those movies where, you know, if it hits you in the right way, you will feel compelled to visit again, because it does so much so right. And to me, it strikes me as this movie that sticks out in Soderbergh's, you know, in his filmography, as this movie where he was emotionally invested in a way that, you know, and not that he hasn't been in other films. I don't want to say that he hasn't, but I felt like he was really emotionally invested in the story and the characters, and that there was a love for the people in it, you know, rather than a sly disdain the way that he is. I mean, Soderbergh has morphed throughout the years and has taken on so many different styles and aesthetics and changes to everything. I mean, the influence of Richard Lester can be felt. You know, there's a documentary aesthetic to him as well at times. You know, I just, you know, anybody that's going to go ahead and try to make something like you said, a colorized version of The Last Picture Show, or attempt to remake a movie, a studio film from the 40s, like, you know, The Good German. I don't know if you've seen The Good German.
Just I haven't.
Very cool.
Or even remaking the Ocean's 11 film and turning it into a trilogy.
And making Ocean's 12, which is the biggest middle finger to the concept of sequels. I love Ocean's
12. I love the sequel, too.
That's my favorite one out of the trilogy, because
same.
Because Soderbergh says to, you know, Warner Brothers, okay, I'll take the job doing Oceans. I'll get all my friends. We'll make a big glossy movie. It does like $200 million. So what, of course, are they going to do? They're going to come after me to make a sequel. Well, guess what? I'm not going to remake the same thing again right away. I'll wait to do that on the third one. But on the second one, I'm going to have it my way. I'm going to make a 60s, 70s styled European kind of a heist movie, kind of a romantic drama, kind
it's
of
it's awesome.
It's so awesome. And like when the whole sequence in Ocean's 12 in the hotel where Bruce Willis shows up, it's
mm-hmm.
I laugh every time about that. Like it's just
it's
so
awesome.
It's so awesome. And I just loved how that movie literally wasn't people hated Ocean's 12 because it's
fuck them if they can't take a joke.
Exactly, but it's because Soderbergh's too smart to give you the same thing over and over again. He wants to subvert your expectations. He doesn't want
right.
you. He doesn't want to make it so easy for you, which is, again, leads me back to my Magic Mike thing. The idea that he made people wait. Okay, all I'll say is this. If Michael Bay had directed Magic Mike, okay, with the same script, he would have reformulated the script, told the same story, but there would have been the dancing number right up front. Like, he wouldn't have been able to contain himself. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like here, Soderbergh is just like, yeah, you know what? They're going to come to see my movie. They're going to all come to see Channing Tatum. I'm not worried about them not coming to see him take his clothes off. I'm going to actually make them sit here and watch a movie. In fact, I could be wrong, but I think that you see a pair of female boobs exposed before you see one male ass.
I don't know, man. All I know is
Olivia Munn.
I was with
buddy.
My buddy. I was with my buddy Peyton.
Watch it again for Olivia Munn. You know, for the least of it, you know, because she's pretty cute. So.
I was with my buddy Peyton and his brother Brent, and we all watch movies together. And his brother was coming over to watch Magic Mike, and I'm like, dude, I don't want to watch Magic Mike. And he's like, oh, just Redbox it. I'm like, I just got the Sunset Limited on Blu-ray. Let's watch that. And then we watch Magic Mike, and we're all just like, oh. And I'm like, see, we should have watched Sunset Limited.
Watch
but
it again.
Anyway.
That's all I'll say. But anyway,
dude, we'll see. All right.
Very, very
let's
glad.
Just,
yep.
You got anything else you want to blow Soderbergh for? Or shall we
no.
segue to our top five Keira Knightley and Sam Rockwell performances?
Yeah,
who, thank God, neither one have been in a Soderbergh movie.
Yeah,
dodge that bullet.
Yeah, we
would. Oh, if that happened, you wouldn't even be able to contain yourself. It would just be like the scream on your end the entire time.
All right. Well, yeah, why don't you get into your...
Wow, I thought I just killed the podcast there.
No.
Anyway. Okay. I'll do my top five. I'll do my top five Sam Rockwell. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right. Sounds good. This is a fun podcast. Hope everybody enjoys it. All right. And my number five for Sam Rockwell, Galaxy Quest. Love Galaxy Quest. Love everything about it. It's a fun movie. Sam Rockwell is just insane in that. As the super fan that gets dragged along on the journey of the film, I love it. He's insane in it. The movie's insane, but Rockwell gives it kind of that extra over-the-top campy edge, which I don't know if it needed or not, but I love him in it. My number four is Iron Man 2. I didn't like the movie, liked the first Iron Man a lot, was all excited for the sequel because Mickey Rourke was in it, and, oh, they cast Sam Rockwell. He's always good. Super excited to see it. I remember seeing it at midnight and just being like, what the fuck? But all that aside, Sam Rockwell is the best part of Iron Man 2.
Yeah, he was.
He's just the best. He's awesome. The anti-Tony Stark. He's fantastic in it. My number three is Seven Psychopaths, which I thought was the perfect follow-up to In Bruges, the director's film before that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Seven Psychopaths was just this wild and crazy film. And I thought Sam Rockwell was a standout of a cast that includes Colin Farrell, Walken, Tom Waits. I mean, it was just fantastic. I think Rockwell is absolutely great in that. Number two, Green Mile. I think that's the first thing I saw him in.
Yeah.
Small performance, but...
Very memorable.
Exactly. The most memorable performance in the film. Maybe even more memorable than Michael Clark Duncan, who does a fantastic job.
It's true.
I mean, Sam Rockwell just brings the fucking house down in that, what, three-hour film? And then my number one is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I remember seeing the movie. I thought it sounded interesting. I thought, oh, George Clooney's going to direct now. That movie not only shows me that Clooney can direct the fuck out of a movie, but Sam Rockwell can lead the fuck out of it and be a fantastic leading man and given complex material that, in a way, sounds asinine, because that's what the plot of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is. Is it a true story or isn't? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I've watched the film probably 10 times. Love it each time I see it. But it is incredibly poignant and touching for as loony as the film is.
Yeah.
I love it, and I think Sam Rockwell is just unbelievably great in it. So those are my top five. Give me yours.
Number five, we're going to see a similarity, Galaxy Quest, hysterical in that movie. One of the first times that I really remember him stealing a movie. There might have been some other instances before that. I'm sure there was, but that was one where he just brought a level of humor that was unexpected, and that movie in general is a pisser, and he was a big reason for that being so funny. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, my number four, like you said, a complex role, emotionally engaging, funny, bizarre, dark. I still don't know what was going on with Chuck Barris, and I don't think that Chuck Barris knew
right.
What was going on with Chuck Barris. So it's one of those great movies. That was Clooney, like you said, making his debut, clearly influenced by the Coen brothers, his work there as an actor, I think, with them. I think they rubbed off big time on him with that one. But yeah, just a really cool movie. Number three is David Gordon Green's Snow Angels. Big fan of this film. Not sure if you've seen it.
Have not.
It is a very, very slow burn, excellent drama, small town drama, about a group of people in a community where, everybody kind of knows each other, and a relationship here leads to something there, and this leads to this. And Sam Rockwell plays an alcoholic, sort of emotionally fragile ex-husband to Kate Beckinsale, and they have a small child, and it's a great movie. It's just I loved it. I've seen it multiple times. I'm a big David Gordon Green fan. I love how he's able to pull something like Snow Angels and Pineapple Express off in the same year, and did so effortlessly, in my opinion. Number two is Duncan Jones's Moon, which is one of my favorite recent science fiction movies.
I don't know, that escaped. That should have been on my list.
Yeah, Sam Rockwell giving just a tour de force performance, really, at the end of the day, as a guy working on the moon alone, colonizing, well, not colonizing the moon, but essentially being a worker, gathering materials and samples and rock and looking for this, that, or the other thing. And I will never, ever hesitate. I will never spoil what's going on in Moon. On a conceptual or narrative level, but it's a one-man performance, one-man show type movie. It's Rockwell, I think a few cutaways to some other people, but it's truly a tour de force performance for him. And my number one is Ridley Scott's Matchstick Men, which I think is a masterpiece. I think it's top five Ridley Scott. It's the last movie that anyone ever thinks about when they think of Ridley Scott, because it's not a huge blockbuster with swords and sandals, or doesn't have an alien in it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I own it.
Matchstick Men, if you have not seen, I am so fucking jealous of you that you have not seen Matchstick Men, and that has the twists, have any of the twists of that movie been?
No, I have no idea what it's, I have no idea.
God, Frank, you got to watch it tonight. End the madness. Watch it tonight. Just preempt anything else you've got going on. That should be your movie tonight. It's so
I was going to try and watch it before the podcast.
It
my buddy
is so,
like,
I will, okay, I'm not going to say, it's because you haven't seen it, I'm not going to say anything about his performance.
All right, I'm glad
other
I
than
interact
the fact,
with them.
It's my number one Rockwell performance. I love that movie. Nicolas Cage's performance is perfect. The sleight of hand direction from Ridley Scott is incredible. It has a casual jazzy style, which is a very atypical of Ridley Scott. It's just the moment I saw that film in a very, very sparsely attended showing in Los Angeles when it opened, I knew right away that it was just going to be one of my favorite movies out of, you know, that year. And I mean, it's a movie I watch at least once a year. No Blu-ray available, only on DVD, unless there's a Blu-ray overseas, which maybe I can grab now that we have the region free player. But I just, it's just so good. I mean, I can't wait for you to see it. And like I said, I am supremely jealous of the fact that you haven't seen it yet, because I would love to watch that movie again for the first time. Why don't you do the Keira Knightley top
five? All right, we'll do our Keira Knightley. My number five is King Arthur. Loved her as Lady Guinevere. So awesome.
Yep.
Just a badass chick. Number four, Pride and Prejudice. I don't know what I could say that hasn't already been said about Pride and Prejudice, so I'm just going to leave it at that. Like I said before, I have a thing for English period piece films, particularly romances, so duh. Pride and Prejudice is on my list. Number three, I just watched it yesterday. Yeah, yesterday I watched Domino. Boom. Loved it. I know it's one of your favorite films. I hadn't seen it yet. Watched it. That's my number three. I love her so much in that. I almost love her in, well, in general, but in that film as much as I love Natalie Portman, and that's a lot. So, yeah, man. Domino. I just... You want to talk about Tony Scott jerking off on the screen? That's exactly what Domino is. And it's just, I started to rewatch it again this morning, and I cut it off when we started recording the podcast because I didn't want to get distracted. But, I mean, yeah, loved it. Number two is Atonement. Atonement blew me away when I saw it. I didn't see it until a couple years ago on DVD. I don't know why I didn't see it, but I watched it, and I was liking it a lot. And then the ending happened, and then the just everything fell out from the bottom for me, and I was completely enamored by it. And that fucking movie, man, is
the shot on the beach is
yeah, what's a bunker? Not bunker.
Dunkirk.
Dunkirk. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. So, and then that movie came out the same year as There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. Nice year for film there. And my number one is Dangerous Method.
Yep.
She is just out of fucking control in that movie. Just absolutely out of control. And I think Dangerous Method is a film that got critically panned, I want to say.
It was mixed.
Not a lot of people liked it, but I saw it in theaters, and I loved it. I love it due to the fact that it's Cronenberg. But it's, I mean, it's on par with greatness as the same feeling of greatness that I felt with The History of Violence. Not to take anything away from Eastern Promises, I love that too. But Dangerous Method is one of Cronenberg's best, and he got four, including Vincent Cassell, four amazing performances out of it. But Keira Knightley, I don't know how she didn't win the Oscar that year.
Neither do I, and I don't remember who did, because you know you never remember who won the Oscar. You always remember who didn't.
Right.
Yeah. Do you have anything more to say before I launch into my?
No. Go ahead.
So your number one is my number five, and it says nothing. It's nothing to do with the lack of love or the quality for it. I just Keira Knightley is one of my favorite actresses, and I've loved.
I know you've seen a lot of stuff that I haven't.
Yeah.
So
Dangerous Method's my number five. Like you said, one of four great performances in that movie, and she's completely out of control, awesome in it, in an unhinged performance. I just can remember her jaw. Constantly moving her jaw.
Jawlock.
Yeah, the jaw, like just crazy. Number four was last year's Begin Again, which is just about as it's a melancholy film, but it's also very sweet. It's from the guy who directed Once. I absolutely loved Once, fell in love with that movie immediately. And Begin Again is another musically inclined film. And it has Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley as sort of lost souls in New York, and they sort of cross paths with each other. He's, you know, kind of suicidal, and she's not really sure what she's doing with her life. And they get together, and they decide to record an album in New York City, like a live album. They're going to record in the subway. They're going to record in an alley. They're going to record on a rooftop. And I just loved it. I thought it was great. Number three is Mark Romanek's Never Let Me Go, which is one of the most underrated movies in the last, like, I don't know, 10 years or whatever. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it.
No.
Carey Mulligan, Keira Knightley, Andrew Garfield. Story of, you'll like this because it's science fiction and it's, British, not necessarily period piece, back in the day period piece, but... do you know anything about Never Let Me Go? Do you know what it is?
I don't.
You don't. It's the story of basically it's kind of like the serious version of The Island.
Okay.
Adults, in the future, we've been able to create clones, and the clones all live in this cut away from society sort of existence, and they're harvested when they are, needed. And you would be blown away. Never Let Me Go, incredible. Alex Garland, who wrote Ex Machina, he wrote the screenplay to Never Let Me Go, based on a book, and directed again by Mark Romanek, who did 1 Hour Photo. Can't say enough about Never Let Me Go. Very good. It's troubling. It's morally and thematically probing. It's a very rich movie. Visually, it's pristine, and Keira Knightley is subtle and extremely effective and very sad, and at the end of the day, that movie pretty much is heartbreaking, so great film. Number two, Joe Wright's Anna Karenina. I was tempted to put a tie between Atonement and Anna Karenina, and I just went with Anna Karenina, and I don't think you've seen this one yet, or have you?
I haven't.
You will flip out.
I know.
You will flip out. It is a stylistic masterpiece for Joe Wright. The movie, I don't know if you know much about it. Visually, it is all of the set is a constantly changing, morphing proscenium style theater thing. it doesn't make any sense how it was accomplished. The cinematography is beyond exquisite. The production design, the costumes are amazing. Keira Knightley is perfectly cast. Joe Wright clearly has, you know, a muse, you know, in Keira Knightley when it comes to these period pieces. Jude Law in a really good supporting role. Just absolutely loved Anna Karenina. It's one of the most visually sumptuous movies you're going to see. You know, I guarantee that. And my number one, without question, not even a hesitation, would be Tony Scott's Domino. One of my absolute favorite films of all time. It's celebrating its 10th anniversary later this year in October, and we will have a devoted show to that film. She completely went all out in that movie, shattered the image of the Pride and Prejudice girl with the shotgun and the short hair and the, you know, the cursing and the screaming and the flipping out and, you know, acting all tough and just so many memorable scenes from the, you know, from the lap dance scene to the sequence at the end in the casino to the opening sequence before those amazing opening titles. She just really grabbed that role by the balls and ran with it and had a lot of fun. And, you know, it just the match, I think, for Tony Scott and her was pretty much perfect. He, you know, he captured a great spirit and essence in that performance. And I think that, you know, maybe it was the British thing. You know, they just that you could just tell that it was a good pairing for the two of them. So that's easily my number one. And I can't wait to talk more about the movie in general, you know, later this year.
Without a doubt. All right. We're running out of time. So let's quickly brush over.
Yeah.
Our
anything to
watch.
Yeah, anything notable?
Yeah, I watched Mr. Babadook, Duke.
Yep,
Mr. Babadook.
Yep.
Last night, I watched it because I see a lot of people talking about it. I know William Friedkin loved it, and I think Shout Factory or somebody just put it out on Blu-ray. It was on Netflix, and
I haven't seen it yet.
I think it was interesting, but very irritating. I just it seems too smart for its own good, gets caught up in itself, and I just when it was over, I just had a feeling of oh, so that happened. So I wouldn't watch it again. I'd recommend you watching it. I'd be interested to get your take on it, but
it's in my Netflix.
It's just yeah, it's just nothing. I don't know. Then I watched Domino. Love Domino. I'll probably watch it again sometime soon. I look forward to us discussing it for our feature film of the week. And it's just a nonstop in-your-face film. Intense editing and performances. Loved it. And then I watched 15 Minutes. I know you spoke to me about that a couple weeks ago, and I bought it for cheap, and I watched it. And you're right when you say it's consistently interesting, but it's just, to me, not a good movie.
Yeah.
I won't watch it again. I'm glad I watched it again after we spoke about it, but I don't think I'll watch it again.
Yes.
So
consistent, interesting. If unsuccessful is what I would refer to that movie as being.
Right. So that's what I watched. What about you?
Nice. Had a chance to catch up with a movie called Straight Time. Which I was really anxious to see. This is a movie from 1978 with Dustin Hoffman. I was one of the many movies I'm catching up with from, you know, the 60s and 70s that have escaped me throughout the years. This is that great, you know, heist film with Dustin Hoffman playing a complete badass. Michael Mann, uncredited work on the script. You could definitely feel his paw prints all over that film. Really enjoyed that movie. Another one from sort of that time period, I watched Richard Lester's Petulia from 1968. Just an absolute game changer, had to have been seen at the time. I can only imagine what people thought of it back in the day. Seeing it now, still incredibly cool and alive and fresh. Great George C. Scott performance. And Julie Crissy just goes without saying, one of, you know, cinema's most beautiful women ever, you know, captured on film. And the movie has a very cool hallucinatory vibe to it. Nicholas Rogue was a cinematographer on it. Great score from John Barry. Just a really cool film. I can't wait to see it again. Only problem is it's out of print on DVD. Also had a chance to catch up with Mad Dog and Glory from 1993, just a great comedy with Bill Murray and Robert De Niro and Uma Thurman, where Denis is sort of when De Niro was flexing his early comedy muscles, you know, after a few sort of attempts, you know, with, you know, Midnight Run and King of
We're Comedy. No Angels.
Yeah. Before he became Mr. Comedy, you know, with Analyze This and Meet the Parents. But this is just such a good flick, Mad Dog and Glory. John McNaughton, such an interesting filmmaker, has been for years. And it's just so cool to see Bill Murray playing the gangster and, you know, De Niro playing the quote-unquote straight guy, you know, to,
right.
you know, to Bill Murray. And just a really fun movie, definitely snuck by a lot of people back in the day. And a movie that, you know, I saw when I was younger, but really had a newfound appreciation for it just recently. So those would be really the big ones I saw over the week. I also saw, obviously, All That Jazz for the first time, and it haunted me all week. As
good, because we're gonna do that for a podcast one day soon.
So, yeah, that's about it for me. And, yeah, next week we should have another good film to talk about. Why don't you introduce that?
Yeah, next week. Well, first I want to say thanks, everybody, for listening and your support and people that took part in our free giveaway and everything. We're still having a shit ton of fun doing this, and the feedback is just fantastic. And just thanks, everybody who's listening, YouTube, iTunes, our website, everything. Our film next week is going to be Mark Pellington's, right? That's the director?
Yep, Mark Pellington, yep.
Okay. Well, it was my pick, so I guess I should know. Anyway, we're going to do Mark Pellington's I Melt With You, which knocked me on my ass when I saw it for the first time. It was just a fast burn, as fast of a burn as a film could be. That's what this movie is. And it strikes a personal and emotional chord in me, like many films have not. And I felt a connection and a deep-rooted appreciation for this film. It's very dark. It's very intense. It's very in-your-face. It's a 90-minute movie about friends who get together once a year and their lives haven't turned out the way they planned on when they all met each other in college. And what ensues is a 90-minute drug, sex, and emotionally draining weekend. And this is one of those movies that we'll get into it next week, but it's critically panned and was called the worst movie of the year, killed the director's career. Yeah, probably hurt some of the actors involved. It's Thomas Jane, Jeremy Piven, Rob Lowe, and Christian McKay are the four friends. Small cast, and I love this film so much. I can't wait for you to rewatch it. I can't wait for us to talk about it. And it's available on Netflix and Amazon Prime for those people who have it, so you can catch up, watch it at your own risk, because we'll be talking about it next week. It's a very intense movie. And we'll be doing the top five of Rob Lowe and Carla Gugino, who are both in that film. So
well, I look forward to seeing it again. And, yes, another great talk. Thanks a lot to everybody for listening. And thanks a lot, Frank.
Yeah, man. All right, we'll catch you guys next week.